Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. Less than a week after Ferguson, Missouri was set to flames by lawless, savage blacks, and law enforcement did essentially nothing about it. Just a few miles away in St. Louis proper, a gang of black youths beat a white man to death with a hammer, yelling F white people and kill the white people just before the attack. The victim was Zemir Bejic, a Bosnian who had recently moved from Iowa. When the blacks swarmed his car, Bejic exited the vehicle and was overpowered by the gang, who repeatedly smashed his face in with the hammer until he was dead. Two other whites were attacked and survived, one of them a young woman who was defended by Bejic. It is to the eternal shame of St. Louis that their politically correct police chief, Sam Dotson, refused to consider this as a hate crime, saying that there was, quote, no evidence to indicate the victim was chosen because he was Bosnian, close quote, as if the Congoids perceived or cared about specific ethnicity, ignoring the glaringly obvious fact that the victim was chosen because he was white. Who are these Africans who freely roam our neighborhoods, who apparently hate us with a passion? Who are these people who burn our cities, take and rape our women, and kill us in the streets? Who are these people who are portrayed as gentle giants or oppressed minorities or genius scientists in the controlled media? Who are these beings whom our overlords have evidently chosen to be our neighbors, classmates, and bedmates? Who they have obviously decided we must mate with, merge with, and literally become? Before we lost control of our media and our government, before the Jews established politically correct censorship over all aspects of our society, there were many scientists, explorers, historians, and statesmen who told us the truth about such things. Today, thanks to a National Alliance supporter, we're going to tell you what these men found in Africa, what they knew, and what we are not supposed to find out today. I offer my thanks to that supporter who sent me a copy of an amazing book by the great American thinker Hinton Rowan Helper, The Negroes in Negroland, which is an amazing compendium of facts from the early white explorers who found the Africans as they were, before they were oppressed or their culture was changed by the white man. In this program and the next, I'll be sharing what I found out about Africans in their natural habitat and what these truths mean for our future. And I warn you, do not allow young children to listen to this program. It is not appropriate for them. First, cannibalism was real and widespread. From Ogilby's Africa, we learn the common food of the natives of Anseco is men's flesh, inasmuch that their markets are provided with that as ours in Europe with beef or mutton. All prisoners of war, unless they can sell them alive with greater advantage, otherwise, as we said, they fatten them for slaughter and at last sell them to the butchers. To this savage barbarity, they are so naturalized that some slaves, whether as weary of their lives or to show their love to their masters, will proffer themselves freely to be killed and eaten. But that which is most inhuman, and beyond the ferocity of beasts, is that the father scruples not to eat his son, nor the son his father, nor one brother the other, but take them by force, devouring their flesh, the blood yet reeking hot between their teeth. From Ogilby's Africa, we also learn, whoever dies, be the disease never so contagious, yet they eat the flesh immediately as a festival dish. Denham and Clapperton tell us, Bello, the governor of Sakatu, said that whenever a person complained of sickness among the Yam-Yams, even though a slight headache, they are killed instantly, for fear they should be lost by death, as they will not eat a person that has died by sickness. That the person falling sick is requested by some other family, who then eat him, and repaid with another victim when they had a sick relation. That universally, when they went to war, the dead and wounded were always eaten. Their hearts were claimed by the head men, and that on asking them why they eat human flesh, they said it was better than any other, and that the heart and breasts of a woman were the best part of the body. Baker's Great Basin of the Nile tells us, many of Ibrahim's party had been frequent witnesses to acts of cannibalism during their residence among the Makarikas. They described these cannibals as remarkably good people, but possessing a peculiar taste for dogs and human flesh. They accompanied the trading party in their razzias and invariably ate the bodies of the slain. The traders complained that they were bad associates as they insisted upon killing and eating the children, which the party wished to secure as slaves. Their custom was to catch a child by its ankles and to dash its head against the ground. Thus killed, they opened the abdomen, extracted the stomach and intestines, and tying the two ankles to the neck, they carried the body by slinging over the shoulder, and thus returned to camp, where they divided it by quartering and boiling it in a large pot. One of the slave girls attempted to escape, and her proprietor immediately fired at her with his musket, and she fell wounded. The ball had struck her in the side. The girl was remarkably fat, and from the wound a large lump of yellow fat exuded. No sooner had she fallen than the Makarikas rushed upon her in a crowd, and seizing the fat, they tore it from the wound in handfuls, the girl being still alive, while the crowd were quarreling for the disgusting prize. Others killed her with a lance, and at once divided her by cutting off the head and splitting the body with their lances used as knives, cutting longitudinally from between the legs along the spine to the neck. In African Explorations by Eduardo Lopez, we learn, the butcher's shops of the Anziques are filled with human flesh, instead of that of oxen or of sheep, for they eat the enemies whom they take in battle. They fatten, slay, and devour their slaves also, unless they think they shall get a good price for them. There are indeed many cannibals, but none such as these, since the others only eat their enemies, but these eat their own blood relations. Africa is also a scene of horrifying cruelty, as we learn in Freeman's Africa. Throughout the day, I heard the horrid sound of the death drum, and was told in the evening that about 25 human victims had been sacrificed, some in the town and some in the surrounding villages, the heads of those killed in the villages being brought into the town in baskets. I learned that several more human victims had been immolated during the day, but could not ascertain the exact number. The most accurate account I could obtain was that 15 more had suffered, making a total of 40 in 2 days. These poor victims were allowed to lie naked and exposed in the streets until they began to decompose. And such is the callous state of mind in which the people live, that many were walking about among the putrefying bodies, smoking their pipes with amazing indifference. Hutchinson's Western Africa informs us, there is apparently in this people a physical delight in cruelty, to beast as well as to man. The sight of suffering seems to bring them an enjoyment without which the world is tame. In almost all towns of the oil rivers, you see dead or dying animals fastened in some agonizing position. Poultry is most common because cheapest. They are tied by the legs head downwards, or lashed round the body to a stake or tree, where they remain until they fall in fragments. If a man be unwell, he hangs a live chicken round his throat, expecting that its pain will abstract him from his sufferings. Goats are lashed head downwards tightly to wooden pillars, and are allowed to die a lingering death. Even the harmless tortoise cannot escape impalement. At funerals, numbers of goats and poultry are sacrificed for the benefit of the deceased, and the corpse is sprinkled with the warm blood. The headless trunks are laid upon the body, and if the fowls flap their wings, which they will do for some seconds after decapitation, it is a good omen for the dead man. In Canot's 20 Years of an African Slaver, we learn of an event even more horrifying than what the Jews say Jehovah asked of Abraham. Amarar called his soothsayer and required him to name a propitious moment for the sally to war. The oracle retired to his den, and after suitable incantations, declared that the effort should be made as soon as the hands of Amarar were stained in the blood of his own son. It is said that the prophet intended the victim to be a youthful son of Amarar who had joined his mother's family and was then distant. But the impatient and superstitious savage, seeing a child of his own, 2 years old, at hand, when the oracle announced the decree, snatched the infant from his mother's arms, threw it into a rice mortar, and with a pestle mashed it to death. The sacrifice over, a sortie was ordered. The infuriate and starving savages, roused by the oracle and inflamed by the bloody scene, rushed forth tumultuously. Amarar, armed with a pestle, still warm and reeking with his infant's blood, was foremost in the onset. The besiegers gave way, and the soothsayer was rewarded with a slave for his barbarous prediction. At another time, Amarar was on the point of attacking a strongly fortified town, when doubts were intimated of success. Again, the wizard was consulted, when the mysterious oracle declared that the chief could not conquer till he returned once more to his mother's womb. That night, Amarar committed the blackest of incests, but his party was repulsed and the false prophet stoned to death. Regarding thought and literature among the Africans, Livingstone's Africa tells us, there is not a single bookseller's shop in either Eastern or Western Africa. Murray's African Discovery tells us there is not a tincture of letters or of writing among all the aboriginal tribes of Africa. There is not a hieroglyphic or a symbol. Oral communication forms the only channel by which thought can be transmitted from one country and one age to another. The lessons of time, the experience of ages, do not exist for the nations of this vast continent. Burton informs us, Eastern and Central Intertropical Africa also lacks antiquarian and historic interest. It has few traditions, no annals, and no ruins. The hoary remnants of past splendor so dear to the traveler and to the reader of travels. It contains not a single useful or ornamental work. A canal or a dam is, and has ever been, beyond the narrow bounds of its civilization. When it comes to African morality and theology, readers, Savage Africa tells us, the Africans are all of them thieves. They have no sense of honor in that respect. I have never yet had a Negro servant, and I have had a great many, who did not rob me of some trifling article, whether he was pagan or Christian. The Africans tell a lie more readily than they tell the truth. Falsehood, like petty larceny, is not recognized among them as a fault. In Baker's Great Basin of the Nile, we read, the Austrian mission station of St. Croix consists of about 20 grass huts on a patch of dry ground close to the river. The church is a small hut, but neatly arranged. Herr Morling, chief of the establishment, acknowledged with great feeling that the mission was absolutely useless among such savages, that he had worked with much zeal for many years, but that the natives were utterly impracticable. They were far below the brutes, as the latter show signs of affection to those who are kind to them, while the natives, on the contrary, are utterly obtuse to all feelings of gratitude. He described the people as lying and deceitful to a superlative degree. The more they receive, the more they desire, but in return they will do nothing. 20 or 30 of these disgusting, ash-smeared, stark-naked brutes, armed with clubs of hard wood brought to a point, were lying idly about the station. Nearby are the graves of several members of the mission, who have left their bones in this horrid land while not one convert has been made from the mission of St. Croix. The London Dispatch of July 16, 1865 says, "The most important and interesting portion of the last number of the Journal of the Anthropological Society of London is the discussion before the Society on the efforts of missionaries among savages, a discussion inaugurated by Mr. Winwood Reed, author of Savage Africa, who stated as the result of his observation in Equatorial Africa that missionary efforts were total failures, even when directed by men eminently qualified for the task. So far from professing Christians among Negroes being better than the heathen, they were, if possible, worse. In plain words, said Mr. Reed, I found that every Christian Negress was a prostitute, and that every Christian Negro was a thief. Perhaps we can learn about the impulsiveness and deep sense of justice of the African, quite relevant to recent events in Missouri, from this eyewitness account in Reed's Savage Africa. The bushman, who has lost his wife by elopement, walks out with his gun and shoots the first man whom he meets. He then proclaims that he has done this because a man has run away with his wife. The clansmen of the murdered man are enraged, not against the husband who has simply complied with a usage of society, but because the duty of the avenger is now cast upon them. As the gay Lothario is out of their reach, they kill a man belonging to the next village. His friends retaliate on their unsuspecting neighbors, and so on rolls this ball of destruction till the whole country is on the alert. The customs of the Africans reveal the psychology of the Africans, as we see in Steedman's Africa. Before they sit down to eat meat in company, the Kaffirs are very careful to immerse their hands in fresh cow dung, wiping them on the grass, which is considered the perfection of cleanliness. Except an occasional plunge in a river, they never wash themselves, and consequently their bodies are covered with vermin. Duncan's Africa tells us, "The Africans pay no attention either to domestic or wild animals. Even the dog or horse, the two most sagacious of all the animal creation, excite in them no interest whatever. If not driven to it, they will suffer a horse to stand for days, tied up without food or water. In fact, in no case do they exhibit any feeling, either of regard or affection, to merit even a comparison with any of the lower animals, being also selfish in the extreme." Moffat tells us, "When a mother dies, whose infant is not able to shift for itself, it is, without any ceremony, buried alive with the corpse of its mother." Campbell informs us, "The inhabitants were so covered with dirt, mixed with spots of very red paint, that it appeared probable none of them had had any part of their bodies washed since they were born." Burton informs us, "Smoke and grease are the African's coat and small clothes. They contribute so much to his health and comfort that he is by no means anxious to get rid of them, and sooty lines depend from it, like Negro stalactites." Campbell also tells us, "On our return, we saw a child, about 8 years old, standing in the middle of the street weeping and being almost a skeleton. It attracted our attention. We inquired respecting its disease, when the women told us the child was well enough and that want of food had brought it into that state, that the mother and father were poor, that he had gone away with another woman and was hunting in the south, that the mother was gone to the westward, searching for food. Neither the men, women, nor children present seemed by their countenance to express the least sympathy or feeling for this forsaken, starving child. They said, laughing, that we might take the child with us if we pleased. I am certain that the sight of this little girl in the streets of London would have excited pity in the hearts of thousands. We took the child to our wagons, desiring the people to inform its mother when she returned where she might find her. When some meat was given to the child, she devoured it with the voracity of a tiger." Du Chaillu's Equatorial Africa says, "The morning before we set out, we accidentally stumbled across one of those acts of barbarism which chill the blood of a civilized man, though but slightly regarded by the Negroes. I was hunting in the woods near the village and saw sitting on a tree at some distance a pair of beautiful green pigeons, which I wanted very much for my collection of birds. By dint of much exertion, I penetrated the jungle to the foot of the tree, and here a ghastly sight met my eyes. It was the corpse of a woman, young evidently, and with features once mild and good. She had been tied up there on some infernal accusation of witchcraft and tortured. The torture consisted in lacerations of the flesh all over the body, and in the cuts red peppers had been rubbed. This is a common mode of tormenting with these people, and as devilish in ingenuity as anything could well be. Then the corpse was deserted. I could only hope the poor girl died of her wounds and had not to wait for the slower process of agonized starvation to which such victims are left. Will the reader think hard of me that I felt it in my heart to go back to the village and shoot every man who had had a hand in this monstrous barbarity?" Here, in these factual and uncensored reports, we have the same realities we see today. Unbridled savagery on the part of Africans, whether in Missouri or Mali, and tender concern for the Africans' souls and well-being on the part of sentimental whites, who, in direct contradiction to the evidence before their very eyes, imagine that the same feelings and ideals they experience exist also in the mentalities of the Congoids. We'll continue this exploration next week on American Dissident Voices. You've been listening to American Dissident Voices, the radio program of the National Alliance, founded by William Luther Pierce in 1970. This program is published every week at whitebiocentrism.com and nationalvanguard.org. Please write to us at National Alliance, Box 172, Laurel Bloomery, Tennessee, 37680, USA. We welcome your support, your inquiries, and your help in spreading our message of hope to our people. Once again, that address is Box 172, Laurel Bloomery, Tennessee, 37680, USA. Until next week, this is Kevin Alfred Strom reminding you of the words of Richard Berkeley Cotton. "Freedom is not free. Free men are not equal. And equal men are not free."
For blood and for soil, we will work, we will toil. Heaven is born on the earth. The heroes arise as we shout to the skies. We will now have our rebirth. For blood and for soil, we will work, we will toil. Heaven is born on the earth. The heroes arise as we shout to the skies. We will now have. Shout.